I was getting dressed, ready to come here this afternoon, and I had I was wrapped in a towel, having just come out of my shower, and all of a sudden I came down my stairs and there was somebody at my front door. And I have a picture window by my front door, and I kind of fell up with a hat with a big basket of fruit wrapped up, a special delivery. There I was in my towel. I quickly put on a robe and I opened the door and I received this beautiful fruit basket from a patient whose child I have helped over the last couple of weeks. And I thought to myself, you know, that's really interesting timing. You know, I'm about to go give this talk and I'm feeling very happy about the work that I do and that I've chosen, I've kind of found in this life. And here is this beautiful representation of thanks and food and love with a very nice appreciative note right for me as I was embarking to come over the bridge to talk to you today. So that was a nice way for me to start this afternoon. I would like to share with you some patient stories from my practice and intersperse it with ideas about complementary and alternative medicine and how I understand the philosophy of natural medicine and how it informs and really gives strength and direction to the work that I do with patients. So I'll talk about some of the philosophical tenets of natural medicine as we go, but I mostly would like to share stories because I think the narratives of patients' lives and how they present in the clinic and how we can use that information in our more broad and kind of integrated understanding of that patient with their symptomatology, I have always found very compelling. I had the opportunity when I was in naturopathic medical school to train with a number of different doctors in different kinds of settings. And one of the things that always struck me was in the allopathic, or sort of more traditional organized medicine that we know in this country, the patient visits are quite short. If you go to a specialist, you might get a good half hour, 45 minutes, but most of the primary care, day-to-day kinds of treatments and interchanges happen within 5 to 8 to 11 minutes, something like that. And it's very hard to really understand a person's whole history, let alone how that history fits in with their lifestyle choices, their social dynamics, their family relationships, their genetic inheritance. You know, it's kind of hard to get all that. So I feel very blessed to have found a particular kind of medicine where long visits are the name of the day. My first visits with patients are an hour and a half. And I do that with little babies, with teenagers, with adults. And I find that I can generally get what I need in an hour and a half. Sometimes I'm done in an hour, but hour and a half is how I like to do it. For my follow-up visits or for acute visits, I might do it in 15 minutes or half an hour. But for my initial trying to understand a patient, I like to take that amount of time. So I would like to share with you a little bit of my experience with patients, but also a little bit of the work that I do in the world of teaching and also teaching medical students, as well as some of my thoughts about the research that is needed to help support and kind of promote natural medicine, and my ideas about the research, where it is right now in this country, as well as abroad, it's a little different in other countries. And also to just sort of spike your curiosity about natural medicine and inspire you to want to learn more about natural medicine, both for your personal needs and use, but also professionally, and also in terms of the political arena, because I do feel like right now, the current administration, there actually is quite a bit of interest in complementary and alternative medicine and preventive medicine, much, much more than we've had in several decades. At least there's verbiage in that direction. And I know that my National Association of Naturopathic Physicians, who has its office in Washington, D.C., has been involved in a number of different ways to try to help impact healthcare reform so that at least there's an eye to complementary and alternative medicine, particularly because it is, for many kinds of conditions in particular, cost-effective, easy access, and something that can be taught through education. We'll talk a little bit more about these different kind of paradigm shifts as we go along. So first patient I'd like to describe to you is a young gal that I saw, a 19-year-old woman, came in, she's a college student, she's a ballet dancer. And when I first saw her, her chief complaint was headaches and depression. Now, those are very, very common complaints. I'm not going to ask people to raise their hand, how many have ever been depressed, how many have had a headache, it would be everybody. But she came in, it was to the point, a lot of people will live with a symptom as long as they can get through their day. But it got to a point where she was not really able to get through her day. So we sat down and we started to have our conversation. And a lot about being a doctor is about being a good investigator who can ask good questions and try to understand how the person got from where they were without the headaches and the depression to this point of headaches and depression, okay? And for me, that's the most interesting part of this work is because I like people and I like to talk to people and understand about their lives, so this is a very good fit for my temperament. I asked her, you know, what was happening when she started to get her headaches, which had been going on for about a year. And she said, well, it's interesting. My headaches began after I started being treated for GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. She had developed GERD somewhat suddenly. A lot of people have heartburn, and when it gets kind of worse, it gets this term GERD, where the stomach acid is sort of touching the insides of the parts of the esophagus that can't really handle any stomach acid. And so, of course, my question then is, well what happened when, why do you think you got the GERD? I'm not that interested in sort of like just the symptom. I'm interested in why did you get it then? What was happening? Were there any big stresses? Were there any changes in diet? Did you move? And I was just curious. So I asked her. So, well, it's interesting. I got the GERD because I started taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories because I had knee pain. Okay, so we're starting to see the story here. She has the knee pain because she's a ballet dancer. And she's, you know, quite elite in the world of dance. So she developed knee pain and she went to her family's doctor who basically gave her the treatment of choice, which is not bad, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Now, some people can take those, the NSAIDs as they're called, and do just fine. And other people take drugs like that and they don't do well with them. She was a sensitive kind of person with a very sensitive system, taking the NSAIDs, and within a couple of weeks, developed the GERD. So for the GERD, what do you take for the GERD? You take the Prilosec for the GERD. Meanwhile, the knee is still hurting. Now she has the GERD, the Prilosec's working, she develops headaches. This sounds like a very complicated kind of thing. This is a very typical story. People come in, they have this symptom, they took this, now they have this symptom, and that symptom, and So I said to her, well, I think that what we need to do is we need to try to back paddle here. Let's see if we can get you off the NSAIDs for the knee. Let's see if we can get you off the Prilosec for the GERD. Let's see if we can address the headaches with some natural medicine approaches. So this was basically the way I worked with her, but there was some investigation that had to go on. And part of the problem is that we, in orthodox medicine, there's this tendency to compartmentalize various parts of the body. So various parts of the physical body, the headache versus the stomach versus the knee, as if this person is not all connected. Not to mention totally sidestepping everything related to emotions and cognition and social environment. So for me, one of the most beautiful aspects of the work that I do with patients, I feel, is that I am not only interested in, but I'm sort of required to understand the patient's symptoms in the context of the rest of their physical body, if it's a physical presenting symptom, and to understand that in the context of their more mental, emotional, and social history and current presentation. So for her, what we did in terms of treatment was a couple of different things. We worked with some botanical medicines, some herbs, that we know soothe the lining of the mucous membrane of the esophagus. Some of those herbs are slippery elm, deglycerinated glycyrrhiza, which is licorice root. And we know that these things work because they have been tested in people, but they've also been tested in vitro in the laboratory. So I like to use approaches that have a little more scientific backing because otherwise I feel like I'm treading on very uncertain water. So I try to do that in my work. I had a wonderful opportunity when I was in naturopathic medical school. I'll talk about the training of naturopaths in a moment. I worked for 2 years for a man named Steve Austin. He was the person who taught in my school there therapeutic nutrition. And the job that he assigned me, now you have to remember this is like in 1982, 1983, before the internet. My job was to go to the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center, that's a medical school in Oregon, in Portland, and I was to review about 200 medical journals a week. And what I did was I basically read the tables of contents and anything that had anything to do with nutrition, herbal medicine, homeopathy, acupuncture, body-mind. Now, remember this, body-mind medicine was just emerging, wasn't even called that then. But anything related to anything natural, I was to go and make a photocopy of the abstract of that article. And if you like the abstract, the next week I would go back and I would go copy the whole article. So of course, my main worry during those years was I spent a lot of time standing in front of a Xerox machine with the heat. I remember leaning against it, the heat right over in my sort of lower abdomen, thinking this can't possibly be good for me. This is probably going to really mess up my fertility, you know, in the long run, which it did not. So anyway, I did this job, and part of what I loved about doing this job was seeing week after week after week how very much there was in the orthodox medical literature. There was no alternative medical literature in those days. I mean, now we have many, many journals in the alternative medicine world. We have journals on acupuncture, on homeopathy, on therapeutic nutrition, on body-mind kind of things. But in 1983, there was nothing. There was Prevention Magazine. That was it. So what I was looking at, what I was finding, what I was being inspired by, were articles in, you know, the journal Gut, or in the journal Hypertension, and the journal, you know, New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, British Medical Journal. And there'd be very good studies. Vitamin B6 in the use of carpal tunnel syndrome. And they have, you know, very longitudinal studies on using something simple and inexpensive with low side effects like vitamin B6 for the prevention and treatment of carpal tunnel syndrome. So things like that, it sort of helped me to feel grounded in my work, that I wasn't just throwing things at people. I wasn't just saying, well, try this vitamin, or try this herb, or try this hydrotherapy treatment. That really, I could see that my treatments were, many of them had already been studied and had been found to be effective, if used correctly. So with this gal, we used some of these botanical medicines to help her reduce the inflammation in the lining of her esophagus. And we also used some just lifestyle modifications with her, such as, she was drinking a lot while she ate. Well, we all know that you drink a lot when you eat, you dilute the stomach acid. It seems like it would be a good thing for somebody with GERD, but actually it causes the slurry of the food, the bolus, to be more liquidy, and then it can wash back more easily. So people with GERD should never drink when they eat. It's sort of a simple thing, but sometimes simple things go forgotten. So that was one thing. Another thing was to take a short walk after her biggest meal of the day so that it wasn't sort of sitting there and pushing its way up. Another thing for her, we had her stop drinking coffee because coffee seems to really irritate GERD for a lot of people. Then we backpedaled a little further into what can we do to help with the inflammation in her knee? Because that was still bothering her and she was still not being able to dance at the level she wanted to dance. So we used some natural anti-inflammatories. We use vitamin C, we use something called bromelain, which is an enzyme from pineapple that reduces inflammation, and we use something called curcumin, which is derived from the spice turmeric, which is also an anti-inflammatory. And we did them in the proper dose, proper amount, and the proper frequency through the day for her weight. And I asked her to come back, you know, in a month and to see how she was. I knew that if we could help her with her knee and help her with her GERD, that her headaches would probably diminish, and her depression, which was really based on the way she was feeling so crappy, would probably be ameliorated, which is what happened. So that's a sort of typical kind of patient for me that represents some of the philosophical ideas that I want to talk about in terms of natural medicine. So one of I'm going to run through them, then we're going to talk about each one a little bit more in depth. The first thing, like all doctors, we take Hippocratic Oath. Hippocratic Oath, the very first thing is, first, do no harm. Let's not hurt our patients. Let's not do anything that's going to cause undue side effects long-term side effects, short-term side effects. The second thing is to be aware of the healing power of nature. And when we say that, we're talking about both the innate ability of the human body to move toward healing. There are a lot of aspects of the way anatomically and physiologically we are hardwired to get well. Not always and not forever. We all also all die. I mean, you know, that is the end for all of us. That and taxes, right? So that said, there are lots of ways which we can support the healing power that is within the body. We're also interested in looking at the healing power of natural things in the environment. Water, light, touch, herbs, things like that, food. Third tenet is removing obstacles to cure. Fourth one is looking at the whole person, both diagnostically and in our treatments. We're going to go through these in a little more depth. Treating the cause of the disease when we can instead of just the symptoms. Focusing a lot on preventive care, both primary prevention and secondary prevention. I'll talk about the difference. Using ourselves, you know, using myself as a teacher, that's the most important part of what I do, is to teach people, model and teach people about healthy living choices, connected strongly with being the communicator. Okay, so the first, do no harm. Obviously, nobody wants to hurt anybody if they're in the healing professions, I would hope. But we really want to make sure that we're looking at the long term. So a lot of medicines that people use and therapeutic approaches that are advocated that are real good in the short run. They just work. They work great. But what are they doing in the long run? Sometimes they're not doing anything bad. Sometimes they are. And so I always talk to patients, I'm like, you know, sounds like that drug is really working for you. Maybe you don't want to, you know, rock the boat. And some patients will say to me, well, you know, I don't want, really want to rock the boat, but I know in the long run, this is not a sustainable drug for me. If I have to get my blood drawn every 3 months to check my liver enzymes because they're worried about my liver because of this Accutane, it's probably not doing me other good too. So some patients come to me that, and other patients it's the other way around. I would say to somebody, you know, I think that Lipitor is really a great drug for getting your cholesterol into the right range, but Lipitor itself has some potential side effects, you know, on some of your organs. Here's some other things we could do to get your liver, your cholesterol into better number range. So that kind of goes looking at the long term as well as the short term. Healing power of nature, you know, one of the things that people will always remind me about is the incredible resources that we have in the rainforests in terms of botanical medicines and how the destruction of rainforests, not only are we losing that and all of the bad things that represents, but there are also a lot of medicines in the plants in the rainforest that are going to be lost. I always think, oh, let's get down there and talk to the healers there who know so very much about things in that area. Some of the kind of medicines that I love to use with patients are water and air. It sounds funny, like how could those things possibly be medical or healing, but hydrotherapy and the use of hot and cold water, either soaking or poultices or, you know, at the sauna and jumping in the cold lake, all the very stimulating to the body can be very healing. And it, at least in the developed world, most people do have access to water and the ability to heat it. A lot of the efficacy in hydrotherapy has to do with the ability of water to hold both cold and heat. So I make a lot of recommendations to people in my practice for both acute and chronic illnesses in the realm of hydrotherapy. One of my sons is a basketball player, and they had an amazing run at the end of their season this year, and the first game that they won leading up to this amazing run, he was very chill and he kind of couldn't shake his chill. So I said to him, why don't you do a hot foot bath before you go? You just stick your feet in some hot water for 10 minutes or so. So he had a bucket, he did the thing for 10 minutes, and they won. So then every game, until the end of the season, he's like, I gotta do a hot foot bath. You're a little superstitious, you know? Very relaxing, very relaxing. Draws the congestion away from the head and the neck, stimulates the immune system, gets the circulation moving. So you can try it if you like. All right, let's do one more, and then we'll talk about another patient. We feel in the world of natural medicine that we really need to remove obstacles to cure or obstacles to healing. Some of these are things that are very obvious, and other ones are not obvious, and other ones we see over time. For example, I had a guy come to see me. This is one of my first years of practice in the 1980s. Lovely guy, great energy, came in with a cane, kind of hobbling over. He was in his early 60s. And the chief complaint was he had a stomach ulcer. Stomach ulcers, you know, obviously pretty common problem, and treated either with drugs or with surgery. And he'd been on a lot of drugs. He'd already had surgery a couple times. He kept getting stomach ulcers. I'm taking his history. I'm just doing a review of systems. We start at the head, we do the eyes, the ears, the nose, and the mouth, any vertigo, problems with the throat, chest. Not hard to do. Just look at the body and just go down every single system. I'm doing a review of systems. I said to him, tell me about your diet. He said, well, you know, I don't eat a whole lot. I said, okay, well, what do you eat? He says, well, I'm a real coffee fan. I said, okay, fine, you know, a lot of people are, you know, before Starbucks, there's a lot of people coffee fans. I said, well, how much coffee are we talking about? He says, well, you know, I put a pot on in the morning, and he ran a cleaning business, that was his work. And I generally drink about 16 to 18 cups a day.
What?
Of course, you know, I thought to myself, oh, that would not be good. But if the chief complaint is a stomach ulcer, and you're basically pouring coffee into the gullet, I mean, you know, Tagamet was not going to help this guy. Surgery was not going to help this guy. He needed to stop drinking coffee. And he'd had that habit for many years. Many, many years. I mean, it was no shock that he had a stomach ulcer. When I said to him, I think if you stop drinking the coffee and you do this herb and you do these dietary changes and you drink some raw cabbage juice, which sounds disgusting, but is an incredible healing agent for stomach mucosal membrane, I think you can get past your stomach ulcer, but you have to stop drinking coffee. If you don't want to stop drinking coffee, then I don't want to take any money from you today. I've already spent an hour with him. I don't want to treat you because that's really the best thing that I can do for you. And if you're not there, then we're not there. This relationship is not going to work. You know, he said, this is not going to work. So he said to me, you mean I have to totally stop? No coffee? I'm like, that would be the best thing. He says, I'll never have another cup. I was like, okay. But that was easy. He says, nobody ever mentioned that to me before. Probably because nobody ever asked him what he ate. And I have to say that Orthodox medicine has grown and evolved by leaps and bounds in the last 25 years since I've been practicing. You know, that would not happen today. That would not happen today. But he quit coffee cold turkey, never had another cup, did the things that I asked him to do, and within about 6 weeks, he didn't have a stomach ulcer and didn't have to be on Tagamet anymore, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So of course, then a few months later, he came and I was like, what's the deal with the cane? Because I was always curious about why he had this cane. And we had talked about it a little bit the first visit, but it was not his chief complaint, and he wasn't really that worried about it. Yeah, he had been in World War II, and he had taken some kind of, I don't know what sort of ammunition to his leg and his lower back, and he had this kind of everything was removed, there was nothing left, but he had spent several nights in some very cold, damp ditch, and he had basically generalized arthritic soreness. It was not rheumatoid arthritis, his rheumatoid panel was normal. He did not have osteoarthritis on any particular joint with swelling and inflammation. He had sort of a generalized discomfort in a lot of his joints. And I basically said to him, well, would you like to try to help that, you know? He said, well, you know, you cured me of my stomach ulcer. I was like, no. I didn't do anything with your stomach ulcer. Your body healed your stomach ulcer. I just gave you some advice that allowed that healing to happen. So we sort of shifted our focus to more of this inflammation in the muscles and the joints. And he came in the next visit with his cane, kind of hobbling like that. And they said, what's this, Dr. Rothenberg? Threw his cane up. I was walk like that, like, that's incredible. That's incredible. One of my all-time favorite patients. Anyway, another patient. So, I have a 52-year-old guy who came in to see me with high cholesterol. His total cholesterol was high, his triglycerides were high, his HDLs were low, and his LDLs were high. So the bad guys were high and the good guys were low. Overweight, probably a good 80 pounds, 60 pounds, something like that. Hypertension and stressed out. That was what he wrote on his intake form. So that basically describes about 20% of America or more. It's a very typical kind of patient for me to see. The world of orthodox medicine has gotten much, much better at treating patients with this profile. Much better. Every patient has to get exercise, every patient has to lose weight, every patient has to stop smoking. I mean, not that they do it, but that is going to be the recommendation from your general practitioner, from your cardiologist, from your chiropractor, from anybody. But I feel that I have a very good way with these kinds of patients. I get very inspired to help them, and hopefully that inspiration carries over and rubs off on them. And I try to do everything in small increments. You know, we're not gonna lose 60 pounds. We're gonna try to lose 4 pounds, you know, like that. And I really spend a lot of time with people trying to understand what's gonna work for them. You know, some people love Weight Watchers. They love it. They love counting points. They love counting calories. They love cutting out recipes. You know, other people, that's never gonna work. They're never gonna count calories, never. Some people, you know, for exercise, they love getting on a treadmill, they love going to Zumba class, or they love doing their Pilates, or they love getting on a stationary bike. And other people, you might have to inspire them to think about what's gonna work for them that's gonna be sustainable. We're not really interested in sort of the short-term gains. We're interested in how can I take this person from now at 50-something to you know, 80-something? How can we take them over time? What can they do that's sustainable with the body that they have, with the energy they have, the money they have, the time they have? Once we get sort of our minds wrapped around that, then we can work with some gentle natural medicines that actually work to bring down total cholesterol, to raise HDLs, to lower triglycerides. We'll use things like red rice yeast, maybe some of you have read about. You always have to use CoQ10 if you use that. Preferentially binds CoQ10 sites. We'll use an herb called Google. It's not like the Google on the internet. It's another herb from India. Google Comfora helps to, works very much like a statin drug, like the red rice yeast. We'll work with vitamin C. There are a number of different therapeutic approaches that replace the need for the statins. I don't love the statins. I find that a lot of them don't feel that good on them, and I worry about the liver, people who take them. So this guy did great. You know, I'm still seeing him, and he's now in a more normal weight range. He got really into yoga. You know, it just, you know, whatever floats your boat kind of thing, it floated this guy's boat. And it's exactly what he needed in terms of something that was also relaxing and enabled him to sort of be in the moment and learn how to breathe and not get so stressed out. The thing about any practice like that that's taken and done seriously over some months or years, it's not so much the effect that the person gets from it when they're doing it or for the next hour. What's more important in a way is the way they can then access that feeling and that skill set when they are in a stressed out situation. You know what I mean? So for example, I was in Cuba a few years ago. I was teaching for a Doctors Without Borders kind of organization there and seeing patients. And I had to do some of the shopping, food shopping for the class. And because the people didn't have much money, didn't have much resources, we were providing lunch. So I was sent to the market. My Spanish is very bad. Okay, it was called what it is, almost non-existent. And I basically had to buy this whole, and it was mob scene, people grabbing stuff. It wasn't a lot, it was a sort of scarcity mentality going on. And I realized that my own anxiety was just going up and up, and I could imagine my shoulders were doing it. And I realized, this should be fun. I'm here to do this. I want to do something good, you know, community service, and I should be enjoying it. And I went into a horse stance. I took a couple deep breaths, you know, and I did a little bit of alternate nostril breathing. you know, things that I've learned over the years from different yoga classes that I've taken, and like in about 2 or 3 minutes, I was like, okay, I can handle this. I can point, I can throw money at people, I can do it just as good as anybody else, you know? So having access to those skills and knowing what it feels like to breathe deeply and to relax and to just be in the moment and not worry what's happening the next hour or the next class or the next week or whatever, that's something that a lot of people, I think, benefit from. It raises their level of health overall because it brings down the stress level. And this guy, with his cholesterol and being overweight and hypertension, his blood pressure, you know, the blood pressure comes right down when the weight comes off. Not everybody. There are thin people that have hypertension, usually due to issues around the kidneys, essential hypertension. But for many people whose blood pressure went up due to gaining weight and being overweight, you know, having a high BMI, those people, the blood pressure will come down if they lose the weight. And I felt like we also derailed him in a good way because he was right on that train to diabetes. I was like, get on that train, you know, gain 10 pounds a decade, by about 50, you are standing at the doorway of diabetes. So we kind of derailed that and helped him to get his blood sugars into a healthy range as well. Okay, who else do we have here? An a cappella singer who lost her voice. Got to talk about her. That is the title of a book that I am, that is at the publisher at the moment that I expect to come out in April. That beautiful poster that Kara made is not the cover of the book, although I wish it was, it's lovely. I think I'm a little bit at the in the hands of my publisher. I don't know what the book's going to look like. It is a book that describes really my evolution as a doctor over the last 25 years, so how I got into natural medicine, what I've loved about it, what I haven't liked about it so much, and a little bit about my story of teaching and writing and that. Told through patient stories. So it's basically a whole bunch of patient stories with patient protocols. It's not a how-to book, but it's really more, here's an example of somebody that has genital warts and herpes, and here's her story, and this is what we did, and here's the outcome. And it's not all great outcomes. Some people, you know, you don't do as well with. There's some of those stories in there, too. So that's coming out, hopefully, this year to coincide with my 50th birthday. Hurrah. Okay. So this a cappella singer who lost her voice, she came to see me, beautiful redhead, long flowy red hair that kind of moved with her as she walked. She was so pretty. And she talked kind of like that. She sounded like she had some kind of something problem in her throat. And I was thinking, wow, that's not a very good voice for an a cappella singer. It turned out that she had chronic laryngitis for about a year. And she'd had several years where she'd get bad bouts of bronchitis, bad bouts of laryngitis that would last for months. The weather would get cold and she would lose her voice. She was a music teacher of little ones. She did like a mommy and me music group by day, that was sort of her day job. And then in the evening she sang in two different a cappella groups that were quite, what's the word? Quite established and quite good. It wasn't sort of a hobby. They were professional, paid a cappella people. I've actually come to a cappella performances here at Smith, the Silver Cord, what's that called? Silver Cord? That's always an inspiring evening. Anyway, she couldn't really work her day job, and she couldn't do the thing that gave her a lot of pleasure either. So I basically wanted to know what was going on 3 or 4 years ago when she started getting really sick. Here's what her story was. She had one child and he had just started daycare. So, you know, daycare centers, there's sort of this germy breeding ground. And he would come home with his snotty nose and his mucus situation and, you know, kids are kids, and she would get sick. And it happened that this is where the illness landed. She thought perhaps it was because she used her voice a lot, she strained her voice a lot, working with little kids, she yelled, not in a bad way, but, you know, higher volume a lot. And this was sort of the area that was susceptible when she got ill. So that was how things began. And when she got her very, very bad laryngitis first time, it's kind of like she never really totally recovered. She did not feel like she had her nice, lovely voice back after that. It came back, but it wasn't, she felt it was tinny. What was the word? It was tinny. It didn't have the nice resonance that it used to have. So at that point, of course, I'm technically advancing with my teenage children. I said to her, can I hear some of your a cappella music? You know, is anything online? So she immediately, blah, 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 and I heard it. They were so inspired and lovely. So I felt more compelled to help her, that I have to get this woman to get her voice back. So we did a number of different things. I gave her, and this is what I sometimes do with people that have a chronic kind of problem that has acute exacerbations. And this is very common with folks that get infections. You know, people that have low-grade sore throat all the time, and then they get it real bad. So I gave her sort of plan A and then plan B. Here's what you're going to do day to day, and if you feel like your symptoms are worsening, I want you to slide into plan B. So plan A had to do with a multiple vitamin, extra beta-carotene. Beta-carotene is the vegetable source of vitamin A that helps to nourish the mucous membranes of the nasopharynx, trachea, voice box, larynx. So high doses of beta-carotene, some use of a botanical medicine that we often use to help with issues with the voice, slippery elm, which I mentioned earlier. So we also use it for helping with the esophagus. But slippery elm lozenges, often used for people that have sore throats from talking too much. So I had her get some of those to use those on a frequent basis. And then I gave her a homeopathic remedy. I haven't really talked about homeopathy yet. Homeopathy is a whole other system of natural medicine where very small doses of particular substances are used that match that person's sort of overall constitutional state, you could say. So I gave her a homeopathic remedy called Natrum Muriaticum, and that was her plan A. Plan B, if she felt herself getting sick, was going to be additional vitamin C, a product called Optibiotic, which is a combination of zinc, echinacea, golden seal, astragalus, a number of other herbs, all known to raise the B and T lymphocyte count and to help fight infection. So she went home with these plans, and also the plan of using something called a heating compress, where after your hot bath or shower, you take a small piece of flannel and you dip it in ice cold water, wring it out really well, put it on this area, and wrap it with a wool scarf. What happens is the body gets a message of something cold on the neck, doesn't like it, and so we send heat to that area. And the way we send heat is by sending blood. That's how we move heat around the body, is by moving our blood. And in doing so, you're moving your blood past organs of elimination as well as past lymph nodes to help raise your lymphocyte count. And this will add circulation to the area, which will bring nourishment in and sort of toxins out. So I instructed her how to do a heating compress to the neck two or three times a week. I don't do it every day, kind of, you know, gets boring and old, but also your body doesn't react as much if you do it all the time. So do it a couple times, three times a week. So she went home with her plan. She was very excited. She was very enthusiastic. And she came back a month later to say that, listen to my voice. Don't I sound lovely? And she did. And she got over that particular laryngitis, and she did not get another laryngitis. That was it. She never got another laryngitis. That's over the last 10 years or so. So I've seen her for other issues. She had perimenopausal stuff. She brought her kid in for things. She finally, at the end, dragged her husband in. It's always like that. He was sort of the last one to come. But for me, working in a family like that, I love it. I love it. You already understand so much about the husband from having treated the wife and the kid. It's very helpful. And the thing about somebody like her is she now is such an advocate for natural medicine. She came in, she was quite, she was lovely and she was open, but she was skeptical. She was skeptical. She was like, ah. And what she said to me was like, I felt like the fourth time they gave me the antibiotics, after the first three times the antibiotics not working, I said to myself, maybe there's another way. So she was on the one hand skeptical and on the other hand desperate. This is a combination I often see in patients. Desperate and skeptical. And I don't care. I don't mind. I'm happy to try to, you know. I know that I can't help everybody with every problem, and if I take a case of a person and it doesn't seem like I can help them, I will say to them, I don't think I can help you. I don't have the skills. My approaches are not going to help with that situation. So. All right, let's talk about a few more of these philosophical ideas here. We want to treat the whole person that I think we've talked about a little bit. I do want to address this idea of genetic inheritance. How is it that we use that in natural medicine? It's not that I am doing genetic testing on people or, you know, splicing genes in my back office. No, I'm not. But I also am not unaware that somebody's genetic inheritance is very important in terms of the kind of illnesses they're going to get and the way they're going to respond to natural medicine. Some people, it's sad to say, have a more challenged path in this life. They come into this world with more challenges, physically, cognitively, emotionally, etc. You know, I certainly believe, you talk about nature versus nurture, that the way somebody's raised is very important. We can do a lot to optimize somebody's genetic inheritance, but we can't totally change it. So if I see, for instance, this week I saw in my practice a very interesting family, three adopted children in the family. And the littlest one was a girl about five, is not a patient of mine. Seemingly quite robust. A 9 or 10-year-old boy, also not my patient, seemingly quite healthy. A 12-year-old boy, who I think, I'm fairly certain, has fetal alcohol effect. So he doesn't have full fetal alcohol syndrome, but he has a little bit of the facial changes that we know from women that have had alcohol during pregnancy or too much alcohol during pregnancy. No amount is safe, but some people can get by seemingly. And he had all kinds of cognitive deficits. He had all kinds of emotional problems. He had all kinds of physical body issues. And this kid's genetic potential was altered because of this toxic exposure. And I think there's a lot of things that we're seeing now in our children. You know, autism, I could spend 5 hours talking about autism. Why the increase in autism? We know now it's way beyond just early better diagnosis. There is more autism. Why? A lot of people feel that it's due to these genetic, the genes being altered at an early age due to certain kinds of exposures. So likewise, if I have a family where I know the parents are both very allergic, eczema, allergies, hay fever, asthma, and they have one child that has a ton of allergies, and now they're pregnant again, I always want to get my hands on that pregnant woman, because there are things that she can do in the pregnancy to make it so the next kid's not quite so allergic. So if we know what we're dealing with, we can actually do some really good primary prevention. We'll aim at that. Understanding environmental factors, a very big one that comes up in my practice, unfortunately, are middle-aged women who have chronic diseases, who are in toxic relationships. It's an environmental factor. And sometimes I'm taking the whole story and history, and I think to myself, you know, I can help this person some, but I really think that the trigger to a lot of their problems and a maintaining cause of a lot of their problems is the fact that they are in a relationship where there's certainly physical, sexual abuse, definitely, but there's a lot of toxic stuff in a home that's not all the way there. Emotional abuse, feeling disempowered, what have you. And it's very challenging for me as a doctor, it's not really my job to say, I think you gotta leave that guy, he's killing you. You know, but that's my urge, that's kind of what I want to say. And I've also seen the same in men, with men who are in very unhealthy relationships, that's part of the environment. And my recommending a diet or an exercise protocol or a supplement regimen and not addressing it, at least addressing it, at least bringing it to the fore, I feel I would be remiss as a provider, a healthcare provider. So, let's see what else we got. Treating the cause. All right, so we've already sort of talked about that. Primary prevention is what I would talk about with regard to finding the diet, the exercise, the stress reduction, the lifestyle that's the healthiest for whatever your genetic inheritance has been. Secondary prevention is more early detection and intervention. So when we first start to see the person's high, blood pressure go up, treating them early. That's more secondary prevention. We can do both. Orthodox medicine can do both. We're all seeing that's way easier and more cost effective to treat people before they get sick, to prevent them from getting sick. It's definitely the way to go. If we can. We can't always. I'm really into shifting this whole paradigm away from like doctor is God. Like that just, I really don't think has worked very well. To doctor as teacher and a person who a patient can relate to and be inspired by and get information from and have a mutual communication going so that it feeds the doctor also. I mean, one of the things that I always felt when I did my rotations when I was in medical school and I'd be in these clinics where it was a new patient every 7 minutes. By the time lunch came, I was like a wet rat. I could not muster the proper, what I feel, would be the proper compassion for the patient, let alone my brain. It was like a scrambled eggs, you know. So I think that a relationship where you really know the person, you remember them when they come back, you have this interaction, you understand about their family dynamics, their work, their children, their grandchildren, I think really, patients love it. Patients really do love it. And of course, the whole idea of doctors modeling balance and healthy lifestyle. You know, doctors have there's a whole field you can study on physician impairment and how many doctors themselves are really screwed up. alcohol, drug abuse, prescription drug abuse, difficult times in relationships and families, etc. So, you know, it's too much stress because the system is wrong. It's not that the individuals are weak, but the system is wrong. And so, when we talk about healthcare reform, one of the things that has to be reformed is the whole way medical school is run. I mean, it's not healthy. So I have a lot of thoughts about that, which I'm not gonna get to all of them. Yes, lots of emphasis on communication, both with the patient, but also with the other providers. Obviously, electronic medical records are gonna revolutionize this. We're all moving toward them. There are some problems with it, it's not perfect, but I think it is the way to go. Here are the main modalities that I use, and I've kind of gone through a lot of these, but lifestyle modification, therapeutic nutrition, botanical medicine, homeopathy, different kinds of body-mind approaches, stress reduction, exercise and movement, and physical medicine like massage, and I will often refer people for different kinds of chiropractic and that kind of moving the parts. Okay, let's see. Another patient. I had a reverse house call a couple of years back, meaning that I was, my husband was out of town, I had three little kids sleeping upstairs, and I was sleeping with them. They were all in one big king-size bed, which we sometimes used to do when my husband was away. And my kids were quite small. And it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I hear on my front door, and the door opens. I was like, oh my God, you know, what do I do? Go down there with kids, protection, where's my people back under my bed, you know, freaking out. And then I hear somebody yell up to me, it's John. I'm like, okay, John. All right, it was John. He happened to be a friend of mine who was also a patient, his kids were patients of mine. So he's holding his son in his arms, and the son is clearly having some problems breathing. He's kind of got breathing very shallowly. I thought I'm hearing inspiratory wheeze. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, what are you doing here? You should be in the emergency room. That's like my first response from my pajama state. So he said, I know, I just didn't want to take him to the emergency room because, you know, he's not vaccinated. If I take him to the emergency room, they're going to think I'm a bad parent, and they're gonna call DSS. It was a whole long story, and I thought, it's okay, I'm just gonna listen to his lungs. If I get some breath sounds, then I'm gonna, you know, I'll work with you. If I can't get some good breath sounds, there's a lot of, you know, bronchi, wheezing, etc. I'm gonna drive with you. You know, I'm gonna get somebody to come watch my kids, and we'll all go to the other get it. Hey, I missed it. So, and I situate him on my lap, and when you listen to somebody's lungs, you listen in the back. And I'm listening in the upper lobes of the lungs, and I get to the middle lobe, and I feel his, about his
around T4, T5, his vertebrae like winged out, way to the side, like that. And I said, hang on one second, I think I know what the problem is. And I laid him down on my kitchen table, like a Thanksgiving turkey. And I, you know, we, in Africa, so we are trained to do some physical manipulation, not a lot, but some. And I did an anterior to posterior adjustment where I had my hand under him and gave him kind of like that. And he sat up and said, oh, that's better, I can breathe. Very interesting. I had to say that if he had gone to the emergency room, he would have had a chest x-ray at the very least. He would have had a lot of inhaled medications and asthma meds and all kinds of stuff. And he just needed an adjustment, you know, very interesting. So the point of the story being that sometimes a mechanical problem needs a mechanical solution. And you gotta be sure you're barking up the right tree. Everything in medicine has to do with the right diagnosis. If you don't have the right diagnosis, then your treatments, it's hard to know where they're gonna fall. So I'm a big proponent of physical exams, laboratory work, x-ray diagnosis. Let's figure out what's really wrong with this person or other kinds of imaging techniques so that our treatments can really be in line with what that person needs. In terms of research, just briefly, I did talk a lot about the studies that are out there. I also think that we have a challenge in that the gold standard of doing in a people trial of doing double-blind, crossover, placebo-controlled studies is very hard with natural medicine because natural medicine is prescribed in a very individualized way depending on the patient at hand. We don't treat people for the diagnosis, we treat them the person that has that problem. So it doesn't lend itself easily to the gold standard of research. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't aim for it, it doesn't mean that we can't try to make it work as best we can, but that is sometimes a stumbling block. There are many more opportunities in the Orthodox medical world now for physicians who are interested in including CAM approaches. There are residency programs. Most medical schools now have at least one class in nutrition, thank goodness. When I was in medical school, the Orthodox medical school, there were three schools in the country you go to and get a class on nutrition, and mostly around deficiency states, as opposed to using nutrition as a therapeutic modality through diet as well as supplements. So that's really good. Of course, there's naturopathic medical school, which if anybody's interested in naturopathic medical school, I'm definitely gal to talk to about it and happy to talk to you and answer questions about that. And here is, this whole slideshow will be available, so you can get these resources, just some of the places that I will often use. The last slide here has some terrific statistics on usage of complementary alternative medicine in America. Breaks it down by race, by age, by income, by complaint, by chief complaint, medical complaint, and by therapeutic approaches. It can be very helpful if you're doing a research project. And then here's some ways you can get a hold of me. You want. Okay, so let me take some questions for a few minutes. We have about 10 minutes, I guess, in terms of when we start. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All
right.
Hang on 1 second. Yeah.
How about an example of where naturopathic medicine just there's no way it could work? Are there any like that?
Oh, sure. I mean, a lot of first aid kind of situations, or any kind of broken bone, any kind of, you know, really bad bleed. Any kind of thing like a heart attack, something that's a real emergency, needs to be in the emergency room. It doesn't mean that there aren't some natural medicine approaches that could be supportive in those kind of situations, but you know, you got a broken leg, you need to get it set. If I have a patient that is resistant to changes, sometimes that's the biggest obstacle to cure, like the example that I gave earlier. If people always say, what about cancer? That seems to be where that question always leads to. I work a lot with patients that have cancer. I generally do not work with patients that have cancer who are not also being treated by an oncologist. So I love working with people when they're in the middle of their cancer treatments to help decrease the side effects from the approaches that they're using and enhance the efficacy while also enhancing digestion, sleep, mental state, all the things that we know can help support somebody during those treatments. There's no complaint that a person would have that I wouldn't try to treat. That said, there are people that I would not try to treat. I had a patient just last week who came in with a long list of complaints. She had pretty much every disease. That's what I would say, she had every disease. And that's okay, a lot of people have lots of diseases. I don't have to treat them, but she was also incredibly negative, and in the first 5 minutes told me about the lawsuit she's in with this one, the disability battle she's in with that one, blah, 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 blah. And I thought to myself, there's no way I'm gonna take this patient. It sounds mean, but I also know I have limited emotional and time resources, and a patient like that could just zap it right out of you. So after about half an hour, I very kindly said, you know, I need to stop you right there. I don't think I'm the right person to work with you. You know, I never charge a person like that. But I have grown into that skill. That is not a skill I always had. But I know my limits, and I feel it's more important that I help 50 other people than get totally dragged down. Even though I probably could help her a little, if I was a cow, right? Yeah.
The singer.
Yes.
You said it was plan A and plan B.
Yes.
Once that situation was resolved,
yeah.
Did she have to stay on plan A?
I encouraged her to stay on plan A. I did. She didn't stay on it for years and years, but for a good year. And then in the cold weather, she went back to it.
Okay.
In the cold weather, because that was a trigger for her. She had a sensitivity to the cold, so when the cold started creeping in, her voice started closing off. So
it's more like she knew what she needed to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
This possible choice of going the ND route versus the MD route, if you know that you're more inclined to the ND, but you feel there might be some disadvantages with not having the credentials of an MD, could you speak towards that?
Sure. There, right now there are 15 states plus the District of Columbia and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico that license naturopathic physicians as primary care providers. And so for the other states, we're not licensed. So if you're not licensed, it's hard to practice medicine. A lot of naturopaths will practice in those states under other licenses, such as a chiropractic license if they're dual licensed or an acupuncture license. So I think that's the main disadvantage. In the last 25 years since I've graduated, there are many more opportunities in different healthcare settings for even unlicensed naturopathic doctors. So that's really nice. I mean, that's a wonderful step in the right direction. Organizations and clinics that have different kinds of providers on staff where somebody else's license will cover the naturopathic doctor's skills who's not licensed. I think for some people, first of all, naturopathic medical school is 4 years after college, and you do not have to do a residency. You can practice right out of naturopathic school. There increasingly are more residencies, and people are choosing to do them. You don't have to. So it's a lot quicker than the longer haul of orthodox medicine, and that makes sense because we do, by and large, outpatient care. We're not learning the inpatient stuff, which is way more complicated. I mean, my work is complicated, but it's not as complicated as far as some of that stuff goes. So I think if somebody's really drawn to naturopathic kinds of philosophy and approaches, orthodox medical school can be very challenging. It's sort of like you have to put your philosophy and your beliefs on hold for 6 or 8 years and put them on a shelf to go back to them, because the pace, the demands, the hours, the residency, it's hard to hold it all. And I've seen people kind of ruined. Versus naturopathic schools, it's not a piece of cake, but it's, you know, if they try to keep it a little more balanced. But some people, it depends on what your goals are. You know, if you know very clearly what your goals are, that you really need to have that MD, then that might be a better choice. It's not that much easier anymore to get into naturopathic school. It used to be easier to get in than orthodox medical school. It's not, there are many more people now that want to go to naturopathic school that aren't able to get in, just because there's limited slots. There's only 5 schools in North America, you know, so. I teach at Bastyr, which is the school in Seattle. I'm actually going tomorrow to teach for a long weekend, to do a homeopathy course there every other month for 3 days for 2 years. And I can tell you that it's a happening place. It is just happening. People are totally turned on, engaged, moving the profession forward. It's very exciting. I love going. I get so inspired when I come there. Yeah?
Have you worked with people with things like chronic fatigue?
Oh, yeah.
Dysregulation,
yeah. Yeah, multiple chemical sensitivities,
chronic Lyme disease, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome. Yes, these people often find themselves at the naturopath door because the orthodox medical world doesn't have that much to offer. I mean, there's more and more. There's some drugs now that are being used, some drugs that are being used off book, meaning that they're drugs for other problems, but they're now being used for those kinds of complaints. Yeah, I do work with people like that. I generally do constitutional homeopathy with them. We clean up the diet, we get the gut functioning well, we try to address emotional issues that may be part of that. And then there are some natural medicines with regard to supplements and herbs that we use depending on what the symptoms are the person comes in complaining of, which are varied. You know, people have different kinds of problems with them. You know, those are not the easy patients. Those are the patients that, you know, really kind of give us a run for the money, and it's a long haul, and we make incremental improvements over time. So, yeah?
Can you prescribe medicine, like traditional medicine?
In the state of Connecticut, where I'm licensed as a primary care physician, I can prescribe certain classes of drugs, not narcotics. So I can prescribe, you know, but I don't.
Oh.
I can, but I don't. But some naturopaths do. Some naturopaths have more of what I would call an integrative practice, where they do quite a bit more allopathic type medicine than I do. I'm kind of a purist in that way, just because of my own interests and passions.
I also have another question.
Yeah.
You said one of your principles was that the doctor should do no harm and that there shouldn't be any side effects. Well, do you think that sometimes the side effects do justify the end results?
Sometimes if a person has particular illnesses, the side effects, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody is taking radiation treatment for, you know, DCIS breast cancer, we know those side effects are quite toxic. We also know that the benefits of using that radiation are very, very good. So yes, you know, I would never stop somebody from something because of that, but I would also try to inform my patient as much as I can when I think maybe we could pull back from that, not something so much with cancer treatments, but other kinds of therapeutic pharmaceuticals. Maybe we can pull back. Some pharmaceutical side effects are totally dose dependent. For instance, it's not exactly pharmaceutical, but something like insulin for an insulin dependent diabetic, either type 1 or type 2. The amount of insulin somebody needs to be on is directly correlated with the side effects, the long term sequelae of diabetes that they will have. So if I can get a person to need half the amount of insulin by using things like chromium and really getting them on a very, you know, high complex carbohydrate diet, et cetera, and exercising, then I know that I'm going to help them decrease the kind of side effects they're going to have from diabetes down the road. So, you know, it's a great question, and this is sort of the way I approach it. Yeah?
What about how much you promote the raw food diet just in general?
I think raw food diet is very, very good for a handful of people. Most people are not going to do that well on it. People, particularly in this climate, they need something a little warmer during some of these months. Some people do very well on it who are kind of hearty and robust, and they can have any diet. They can have any diet. But other people, it's not enough variety, and most importantly, it's not sustainable in time, in money, in social life. Most people who do it for a period of time and continue to have and add a lot of raw foods in their diet, which I think is great. I think everybody would benefit from that, but they don't do it entirely. My daughter I'm vegetarian for about 45 years. My daughter was vegetarian from birth, and when she got to college, she decided she was going to become vegan. And I thought, oh, and of course, Colorado College has a great vegan menu, et cetera. But I felt like she got less and less and less healthy and strong on the vegan diet. And after a year, she sent me a text which said, I quit being vegan today. I was like, yes. This is hard, you're warming, it's farming. All right, I have one more question, and I don't want to go over our time. Yeah?
How does aromatherapy and essential oils?
Oh, yes. Aromatherapy and essential oils, yeah, we know that the sense of smell is a very engaged sense for many, many people. And aromatherapy, it works to sort of bring a certain kind of energy and vibration into the body, and I think can be quite lovely. Is it going to cure people of like major disease? Probably not, but it certainly isn't going to hurt, and it's nice. And we know there's a whole field, psychoneuroimmunology, you know, where we're looking at the effects of the mind and the emotions on the body, and if we do things to help people feel better, they basically feel better. So I don't underestimate things like that either. Color therapy, all those kind of things. Reiki, therapeutic touch, I love it all. I don't do it all, but I love it all. So thank you very much for your attention, and stay healthy.